After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hi everyone, it's Raghu, and I want to introduce you to a podcast that I did with Lama Tsultrum Alioni, a very good and old friend of mine and many of the other people that you hear on the Be Here Now network. And it's a conversation we had around her new book, Wisdom Rising, Journey into the Mandala of the Empowered Feminine. I want to tell you a little bit about it, but before I do that, I just want to just mention directly, you've heard a lot over the last few months about 1440 Multiversity, the incredible and incredibly beautiful retreat facility near Santa Cruz that is just holding some of the most, it's hosting some of the most wonderful and talented and wise people in all walks of life at 1440. And we're just so happy to have them as a partner for the Be Here Now network. It's our values are so aligned, and we are really also so well aligned with our purpose, our mission to really help as best we can get as much information out to everyone, including ourselves, to get to a life in balance. And I do want to mention a couple of, so one incredible person named Dr. Shefali, who does a lot of work around conscious parenting. And if you've seen any of Oprah over the last few years, Dr. Shefali is a frequent guest with her, and she is, the podcast isn't up yet. It will be in the next week or so, so you'll be able to get a taste of what she has to offer. And she'll be at 1440 April 20-22, and also, around that weekend, same time, Dan Siegel, who is very well known, will be doing a workshop around developing stronger skills for stress resilience. Those of you who don't have any stress shouldn't bother with this, but that's probably, let's see. I think I know one person alive right now that actually doesn't have stress, and that's a whole other situation. Actually, you'll hear about that on a podcast that I've got coming up about my trip to India, where I have been doing these. We did some field recordings, and it'll be coming up soon around this particular being that we met in the jungles of India. So 1440, if you're around California, go see, go register, go to 1440 Multiversity and register to go and take that workshop either with Dan or with Dr. Shefali. Now, as far as Lama Tsultrum is concerned, she just speaks for herself. She has been with some of the greatest Tibetan lamas of the last century. Maybe that's a little dramatic, but not that. Particularly the Karmapa 16th, who I also had a darshan of at one time, and I've said this on previous podcasts, he was no more or less, it was just exactly the same space and spaciousness and no eye at all that you could observe as Neem Karoli Baba's Maharaji. And in this book, she has there's a lot of personal anecdotes in this book from Lama Tsultram that are just precious, and particularly around the 16th Karmapa, and how as a young woman, like a teenager, 19 years old, she met him and committed a few faux pas, and he didn't even blink, and he just loved her, and he ended up ordaining her as a Tibetan nun. There's a lot around mandala in this book, and Dakini, and she'll explain all of that, and you'll get a real feel for it in the podcast. The other part of this that really fascinated me that we got into that I wasn't thinking we were going to get into was around Carl Gustav Jung and his whole thing around mandala, which I never really knew about. Quote that strikes me here that our people have picked out: the mandala serves a conservative purpose, mainly to restore a previously existing order. What restores the old order simultaneously involves some element of new creation. In the new order, the old pattern returns at a higher level. The process is that of an ascending spiral which grows upward while simultaneously growing again and again to the same point. Jung, Carl Jung. We'll have to go through that and listen to that about 100 times before we can totally understand it. But Lama Tsultram does talk about this in the podcast and in the book. It's fully dealt with, and also her personal encounters with the Dakini, and how we can all find that Dakini in our own lives. So we finish with the topic, my current obsession in podcasts, which is the topic of karma and how its wisdom can help us identify and address our habituations and detachments in a practical way. So this is a rich podcast with Lama Tsultram. I hope you enjoy it. And also do check out, you go to 1440 Multiversity and just hit the website and see all of the programs that they have lined up. I mean, it's just, like I say, it covers everything from, I saw some stuff around food and how to relate with body wisdom, and how to, as Dan Siegel doing that stress thing, skills for stress resilience, conscious parenting. They just have just about everything we could all want to take part in to add to significant information and wisdom to help us on a day-to-day basis, which is what we try to do here at Be Here Now Network. So here we go. This is Lama Tsultram Alioni on Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Hi, it's Raghu. I'm back with Mind Rolling. And I'm back with Lama Tsultram Alioni. Everybody, you all know Lama because she's been on the podcast before. And she's part of our family of teachers that have been together over many decades around Ram Dass and Krishna Dass and myself and others. So welcome. Glad to see you again, Lama.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
And Lama has a great new book that I just went through coming called Wisdom Rising, A Journey into the Mandala of the Empowered Feminine. And when this podcast comes out, you'll either buy it straight out or you'll pre-order it. One of the two. And all of that information, of course, will be on BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling. We'll have all of the links and everything else. So one thing that struck me is, let me see if I can find it. It's around really the scope of this book and how you talked actually about the relevance of it related to the feminine and related to, like, making this pointedly towards women, and the fact that what's going on now, it's very, very topical, obviously, in this society and so on. You say, we also see, there's a lot in here about Dakini, which you'll explain that in shortly, and also Mandala. Those are two important aspects of the book. And we also see that the Dakini is not only relevant for women, it's equally relevant for men, or she is equally relevant for men. I'm relating the Dakini to women in this book because I feel she provides particular strengthening and empowering qualities that we need right now. But we should understand that in Tantric Buddhism, men practice with male and female deities, and women practice with both female and male. So this is probably a good thing to expand and relate the scope of the book in that, putting it in that direction, Lama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the feminine as it's rising now is a political issue, but it's also a spiritual issue. And so part of what I talk about in the book is how women in nature have been treated in a parallel way, in the sense that whenever nature has been disrespected and neglected, misused, so have women. And I track that historically and statistically also. And so what's happening now is really at a crisis of near extinction of humanity and many species. You know, we don't talk so much about the potential extinction of humanity, but it's actually, it's a possibility, especially with the leadership that we have now. Yeah. And, So we've really brought ourselves to an extreme situation, we could say, in nature and also in terms of women. And so the arising that is happening now with the women's marches and Me Too and Time Is Up and so on, all those incentives, to me, also have spiritual roots and a potential spiritual solution, or at least a spiritual addition, I guess you could say, an additional spiritual component. So in the book, I talk about the Dakinis. And they are embodiments of wisdom. They're fierce and they're fabulous. they dance. They are dancing. They're sexual and they're spiritual. And they're also, they oversee nature. And I can tell some stories about that also. So the Dakinis are probably the most important aspect of the feminine in Tibetan Buddhism. And it's also an energy of pulling the rug out from under you. And also the Dakini energy is something you often meet when you're in transition. And we are certainly in transition right now as a culture. And I wonder how many people who are listening today are also in transition in their lives. I wouldn't be surprised if there were quite a few, because often the Dakini comes to you or appears in your life when you're in transition. In any case, the Dakini is this wild and wise energy of the feminine, very powerful, very potent. And in Tibetan Buddhism, a male could practice a Dakini practice. And in fact, all serious practitioners do, male and female. And a male teacher could also practice Tara, for example, a male teacher or student. And then vice versa. So women would practice male deities, which is kind of one of the cool things about Vajrayana or Tibetan Buddhist teachings, is that it's gender fluid in the sense that you actually, like Bhagu, if you were a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner, you would probably do a practice like Vajrayogini, who is a female energy connected to the inner heat practice and so on. And you would become her, right, in that practice. So practitioners do both and move into the actual experience of being a different gender, but it's a gender, like a transmuted gender or a transformed gender, in the sense that these beings, the deities in Tantric Buddhism, are really luminous, pure light energies that are embodied in these various forms, and which we as human beings who are not pure light beings, we're in element bodies, we identify with them to sort of like actually illuminate literally ourselves through identification, visualization, mantra, and so on. And so that quality of the Dakini I see as being really important right now, because a lot of what's arising in women and in men is anger. There's frustration, there's feelings of fear that produces anger, fear of having our rights taken away, and so on. So we have this upsurge of anger, which we see in all these movements. But then what do you do with that? Obviously, you can do legal actions, which are important. But how do you transform that energy in your own body into something which is transformative in a positive sense? How do you work with that anger to create the change that you want to see, and also to keep it in your own center, to stay centered, whole, and to act with wisdom and not just act out of random anger? And so the mandala, which you mentioned also in the beginning, the book is called Journey into the Mandala of the Empowered Feminine. So in the book, I take you both my journey, which is somewhat of a memoir, which you read and found familiar places and people in it. And it's, so it's got that quality. So it's my journey, but it's also your journey into this mandala. So a mandala literally means the center and the fringe. And so actually I have a mandala right here. I'm going to hold it up.
Yeah,
this is a mandala.
Beautiful. Yeah.
So this is a Tibetan mandala. And cultures all over the world create mandalas. But the Tibetan tradition really developed this idea of the mandala, the specific meaning of each direction in it. And so what it is a centering template or a blueprint of the enlightened mind. And actually, although we see, like with this one, here we go, it looks two-dimensional, right?
Yeah.
But actually it's three-dimensional. A mondo is actually a palace. And within that palace, there are deities. In the case of the five Dakini mandalas, there's five, center and four directions. But you've been, I know, to the Kalachakra empowerment with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. There's over 200 deities in that mandala. Hmm. And then there's four doors that go into it, four gates. And so when you place your mind, your psyche, into a mandala through visualization, you are creating a holistic space in which you're placing your psyche. And that then reunites the fragmented psyche, our fragmented mind that's all over the place, into wholeness. And so that's the power of the mandala. So in the book, I talk both about the Dakinis and then the five families connected to them that are in the mandala, and also the meaning of the mandala.
Hmm. How, I mean, for everybody listening, and of course, there are many people, and you and I have discussed this before, and we've discussed it when you came to Maui to teach at the retreat, about how can we get this related in a way that somebody who's not a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner necessarily can actually use the concept and the practice in a way mm-hmm. that is, because what you were talking about before, the fragmentation, the separation, the polarization that's going on now, the loss of respect for feminine principle that's endemic, obviously, with everything coming out, and that at that displacement, and the fact that the Dakini comes at that time. Can we talk about it in a practical term where people feel this kind of displacement, mm-hmm. and how do they actually experience the energy of the Dakini, and how can they use it to heal? Mm.
Yeah, that's a good question. The five families, which are what the five Dakinis are connected to, are something that anyone can relate to. So these are called the five Buddha families, and they're connected to obstructed emotional patterns, directions, colors, times of year, times of day, and so on. But the key piece of the five families is the transformation of the obstructed emotion into wisdom. And so, for example, let's say your Padma family. Padma family is connected to desire, grasping, craving. Padma people, for example, are not really able to go deeply into relationship. They're very interested in seduction. And the energy, the magnetism that it takes to seduce someone, but they don't, once you kind of get into the work of a relationship, they're not interested anymore. They like that superficial energy buzz that you get mm-hmm. through seduction. So let's say you're Padma and you have that, yeah, that's your issue, we could say. That very energy of Padma, that grasping, craving, desire, has within it the potential of wisdom. When the grasping quality, the holding on to quality is released, that energy becomes wisdom of discernment or all discriminating wisdom. And so that wisdom can see relationship. It can see relationship of objects, for example, colors. So the Padma family is connected to the arts, colors, shapes, and so on, and also can see relationships with people, but doesn't have that personal investment in it, can see with a discernment and work with relationship and work skillfully with people. But without that selfish, obstructed, encumbered pattern of the emotion before it becomes wisdom. So that's one example of the five families. And so there's one connected to anger, and that becomes mirror-like wisdom. There's one connected to pride, which is also a feeling of not being good enough, not being enough in yourself. So you have to inflate yourself, pretend to be more. So that becomes wisdom of equanimity. And then there's one connected to jealousy or envy, which is also connected to speed and ambition. And that becomes all accomplishing wisdom. And then the central one at the base of them all is connected to what's traditionally called marika or ignorance, non-recognition. But that hooks into the emotions of depression, denial, procrastination, spaciness. And that spaciness becomes spaciousness at the wisdom level, all accomplishing wisdom. So your question was, okay, how can some non-Buddhist, normal, are any of us normal? How can somebody that doesn't relate to this or know this framework relate to this, these ideas? So the five Buddha families are very relatable. Once you hear them, you'll know which one you are. Maybe you're connected to a couple of them. Mm-hmm. And then what I present in the book is how to work with certain sounds, which are called seed syllables, and light, color. So sounding a seed syllable and light to transform those emotions into the wisdom. That's the method. And then they're all connected to the mandala. And so you do this transformation through light and sound in the structure, in that blueprint or template of the mandala. And so all of the obstructed patterns, at least while you're in the meditation, are transformed into the five wisdoms.
And it's well laid out in this book, many, many different practices. Actually, for each chapter on the family, the five different families, each chapter has practices. So everyone who's listening out there, it's fairly direct. I wouldn't say just simple, but even if you are not practicing Tibetan Buddhism, you could look at these things, especially around mandala, because I think many people have an affinity once. I don't think there's anyone who doesn't see a mandala and sit for a moment with it. You can't just go, oh, that's nice, and move on. I mean, I think it would be very difficult to do that. So if you just take that initial response to the first of all, grasping the concept of the mandala, and then sitting with it, I think you have a great beginning point in being able to follow some of the practices in the book that you would feel comfortable with, and that could really to help, as Lama is saying, transform negative emotions, which we're all dealing with on a day-to-day basis. One of the other things that, by the way, now I guess I just didn't know a lot about Carl Jung. I mean, I know, like everybody knows, and I even did some therapy work with a Jungian analyst many years ago. But I didn't know the breadth of his relationship with mandala. And you quote him, the mandala serves a conservative purpose, namely to restore a previously existing order. What restores the old order simultaneously involves some element of new creation. In the new order, the old pattern returns at a higher level. The process is that of an ascending spiral which grows upward while simultaneously returning again and again to the same point. I mean, he's phenomenal, and you really do talk about this, and there's some just throughout the book actually. There's a lot of references to Jung, so that obviously was very important too. And then there's one towards the end, Lama, that knocked my socks off because it's you talked. Let me see if I can find. Oh, this whole thing about one of his students, Dora Kalf.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
She was trained as a Jungian analyst and also studied Tibetan Buddhism. She developed, and when I read this, I went, holy Jesus. She developed the now world-famous sand play therapy. So I don't even think I ever told you this, but when I first went to India, Ram Dass was there, and he said, as soon as you get to India, I came there maybe a couple of months after he went back the second time. He said, you know, write to me, and I'll, wherever Maharaj Neem Karoli Baba is, you know, I'll tell you where to go. And he couldn't find him, and which is where you all met. I wasn't at that, the Vipassana thing in Bodh Gaya, right? I met you after that, but that's where you met everyone. And I was at the Sri Aurobindo Ashram in southern India, right? And I went, and there was a Swiss psychologist who was also a student of Jung. And I went, and I was visiting him, and I noticed a few sandboxes. And I said, oh, you have children here? And he said, well, yeah, they do, but really it's for adults. They come and you just play, and then we examine what it is that you've done. So I said, well, I'd like to do it.
Can I try it?
Oh, my God. So I did it. And what I did ended up, he said, this is the archetype of the Western penchant for saving the world. They're going to come, and I had a cross in the middle, and I had something in each direction, in each corner. I had it all perfectly laid out. It was like crucifying myself. And the interesting thing was, I went, and I don't know if you know, Sri Aurobindo had a partner, mother, who was a saint, and I went there because I wanted to meet her. And she was not well, and I couldn't meet her. Meanwhile, I did this thing. Right after I did this reading, playing in the sandbox, which revealed all of this, you know, sexual stuff and a whole realm of like where I wasn't. I got so sick. I got hepatitis, right? Oh. And then I was really sick. And then as I got healthier, I started reading the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna and came into my first contact with Divine Feminine. First time I really had any relationship through him and through that book. And then right after that, I got better, and I had a darshan of Mother. And I went into a room, and she was very old. I think she had Parkinson's because she had lost motor control, and I was completely freaked that I was going to have to, you know, am I going to get caught in some old person's, you know, I was 24 years old, okay, whatever. And I went in there, and it was the classic nothing but light, and she just totally enveloped me in the goddess, the feminine. I mean, it was just, they had to drag me out of there. I mean, I'd lost all awareness of anything. And I went back, and I did a sandbox again with this psychologist, Jungian guy. Uh-huh. And my whole thing transformed completely as a result of this emergence of a connectivity to Divine Feminine. So when I read this, I remembered all of that. I hadn't thought about it in forever. It was, anyhow, my little story there.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that about you.
Yeah. So
so he was probably connected to Dora Kalf then.
Yeah, he must have been because he was from Switzerland, yeah. So yeah, Jung, you're obviously a very important figure for you because it's very much in this book his.
Yeah, and I talk about in the beginning how I was and when I was 16, I was in Harvard Square wandering around because my grandparents were retired professors in Cambridge, and I was in the coop, you know, the Harvard coop, that big kind of department store connected to Harvard. And I came upon this book, and it had a Tibetan mandala on it, and I was struck by what you just said about it's really hard to not stay with a mandala when you look at it, you know. So I saw this mandala. Might have that book here somewhere. But anyway, I saw it, and I couldn't take my eyes off the mandala. And it was like I went into it and started going into another dimension through it. And here I am, you know, 60 years old in a bookstore in Cambridge. And it was called Man and His Symbols, Carl Jung. And so I bought it and I took it home to my grandparents' little white house in Cambridge and opened it up, and it had Tibetan mandalas in it, as well as other things like the rose windows and chakra and, you know, the maps of cities that were mandalas. So you kind of tracked how mandalas are everywhere in that book. And it had just been published actually at that year. And so it was that book that was actually the thread that I was following when I went to India in 1967. I wanted to learn how to paint mandalas because I was a painter. And so that's how I ended up in Dharamsala and met the Tibetans. And they told me it would take a year to learn how to paint one mandala. And I was like 19, you know, I wasn't going to spend a year, you know, looking at that. So, but anyway, it was the image of the mandala that actually brought me to the Dharma.
Wow.
So it's interesting for me now, you know, with all these decades that have passed, to be writing a book about that. So in a way, it's sort of like, you know, what that quote that you read from Jung about the spiral.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the spiral that it's the same spiral, but it's new. And it keeps taking you deeper into the center of the mandala.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, Jung is interesting, very interesting. Very interesting figure. And also, he was very connected to Tibetan Buddhism. And also the I Ching, which you probably remember, you know, that Wilhelm and that whole idea of synchronicity.
Yeah.
That is part of throwing the coins in the I Ching. Yeah.
God, I haven't done that in a long time. That was really a part of growing into the East. But I also Sorry, go ahead.
We did it yesterday here.
Oh, really?
At Tara Mandala.
Oh.
We do it every year on Tibetan New Year, and we look at the we do it for Tara Mandala for the center. And it's kind of like a prophecy and also guidance for the coming year. So we just did it. I was talking about this yesterday to the community that were here at my house, because we for Tibetan New Year, we have this series of parties, and we go from different people's houses at Tara Mandala starting in the morning. And so we did this at my house in the morning, and I was talking about Jung and the I Ching and the mandala, and you know, how this has really been an important part of my development. And the idea of synchronicity, which is really interesting. That Jung wrote an essay on that, and he was the first one to really write about that.
Fascinating. And by the way, everybody, in this book, as Lama Tsultrum says, this is part memoir to the book, and just wonderful stories of your journey, like little things, like you're 18, 19 years old, you get there and someone tells you about His Holiness, the 16th Karmapa, and you go over there and they're doing these, you know, important, quote unquote, rituals and rites and all that, and you pop into his room and just go over there, you know, just without any... shall we say, or anything, and how he, and he lit up, how you say, he lit up with the most gigantic smile. And I mean, I relate with him so much because I did meet him as well. And he was just Maharaji. There was no difference whatsoever. I mean, between the two of them in the, on the ultimate plane, So just that one little sentence in the whole book was like, oh God, so great. And
you remember that feeling? Yeah.
Mm, mm, I bet you, you know, that's something that is with you forever and ever and ever. Yeah, really. Lovely. You said before, yeah, go.
Well, I was going to say, as I said earlier in that story, that I had heard about Karmapa, but I heard he was really fat and that he wore a gold watch. And so I didn't want my guru to be fat or wear a gold watch. And so I didn't want to go see him. I wanted a thin, yogic looking guru.
Hollywood guru.
So I didn't, eliminated him as an option. Which I later realized was so ridiculous.
Well, then you tell the story of you did meet a really beautiful looking Tibetan yogi who you were thinking, now this would be a good guru. And he said, Karmapa's your guru. Jow. Probably Jow. That's so good. So we just before you were talking about Dakinis, and you said, I have a couple of stories. Let's hear a couple of stories, at least one, about an experience with a Dakini. I mean, I know one. I could prompt you that because there's a picture.
Prompt me.
Prompt you? Okay. You did a ceremony at... actually, you know what? I just talked to our mutual friend, and I thought it was at Taramandala, but it was actually when we were all living in New York, in upstate New York, when you were there by the lake, and you did a ceremony there, and the manifestation of that cloud, which there's a picture of the Dakini. Tell that story. That's.
Yeah, that actually was in Ojai, California, the Ojai Foundation. Yeah.
Okay, so it happened more than once because Michael remembers it being in Rockland.
No, it was, I had the photograph there in Rockland, but I was at OHAF Foundation doing a retreat. I think it was 1989. And we had done a Dakini retreat. And it really was very magical. I had just met my husband, David, and he was there with me. And there was something about my energy with his energy that was very alive, vibrant. And the retreat was incredible. There were probably 50 people, maybe 40, I don't know. And we did, it was pretty long, like 2 weeks. And we had worked with each of the five families in this process that I've been talking about, of working with the obstructed emotion, but much more in depth than what I just told you, for five families. And so at the end, we had bought out all our masks. We made five masks also for each of the five Dakini. So we brought out all the masks to do kind of closing ceremony. We put on the first one, the Buddha Dakini. And I had had a dream the night before of a white bow that went all the way across the sky, like started at one horizon and went to the other horizon. Very weird thing to dream about, but striking enough that I had remembered it in the morning. And so as we were there with our mask, that bow formed in the sky, this arc of white light over us. And then I was like, wow. And then the white turned into the Dakini. And she was not static. She was dancing. And it was really clear. You can see it in the book, the image. It's not like you have to like use your imagination.
Imagine, yeah. No.
No. Not at all. And so she was there for about 20 minutes dancing with us, and we were dancing with our masks on. And we were in such a kind of altered state that it didn't even seem that weird that there was this Dakini in the sky dancing. Somebody did have the wherewithal to get a camera and take a picture, but I didn't think about taking a picture. I was just in this process. So, the Dakinis have a way of taking you somewhere you need to go when you're in transition. And one of the things, another kind of story that's connected that I was thinking about with the Dakinis that came up actually while I was writing the book was, I was writing about this idea of Dakinis appearing when you're in transition. And I had just been to the birth, the fourth birth of my children that I have attended. And it just had happened. And it was my older daughter, Sherub, who you know. And she was 43, second child. You know, 43, you don't get pregnant that easily, usually. So anyway, it was a very wanted baby. And she's very athletic, you know. She does these things like ski races where you run up the mountain with your skis and then you race down the mountain. But birth was a whole other thing, you know, that like no matter how athletic you are, it takes you through it. And so when she was in this time called transition, you know, when that last few centimeters of the uterus opening, when the baby goes then into the birth canal, is called transition, and it's the hardest time of labor. And so what I saw in that moment was she became so powerful and so wrathful and so like no nonsense and don't ask me any stupid questions and you know like I have to do this. And she was in like a bath, you know, water birth. And so each contraction, she was like, wow, out of the bath. And she was shaking and she was the Dakini, you know? And I was like, this is another aspect of the Dakini, the fierce feminine that women have to get in touch with to have a baby. That you have to, at least my experience is, at some point you have to connect to your primordial animal wildness to give birth. And so anyway, this energy, she was also kind of dancing. And the Dakinis dance, and I was like, this is it, this is transition, and this is the Dakini, and this is feminine fierceness in its most primal form. So that was really, it was like, when, you know how you kind of go along, like here I am writing this book, and then all of a sudden something happens in your life and you're like, this is what I'm trying to say. This is what I'm writing about.
That connection to that visceral, raw, feminine energy. You do talk about, this is not about, ultimately there's no gender. You talk about that in the book. Is there a way for a male practitioner to bring that energy? And I mean, I feel like when I said that I did that whole sandbox thing in South India and then had Darshan of Mother and read that the Ramakrishna book, suddenly I had finally a real connected, because I had a terrible time with, as everybody, parents in that time, you know, it was very difficult. Not everybody, but so there, that was the beginning of something that was really powerful for me. Is there a way to actually engender that in practice as a male, to engender the feminine within the male and that aspect, which most males are terribly afraid of?
It's interesting that you're using the word engender. To go into the gender, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, men do the Dakini practice equally as often as women. And they need that too. They need that strong, powerful, primal, wild woman in themselves to balance, you know. And that's, you know, that's again Jung. He was like, male, the unhappy male is often unhappy because he is disowning his feminine. He's not allowing her. He's not giving her her rights. And so, you know, the way that Jung first started talking about the anima and the animus meaning the male aspect for the woman and the anima, the female aspect for the man, it actually came to him when he was finding himself, I've forgotten exactly the words he described, but he was disturbed and he was kind of angry and nasty, you know, and he couldn't figure out what that was, you know, what was that in him that was happening. And when it came out, it was his anima, it was his feminine. And he allowed her to take form and he dialogued with her. And then that whole part of him, that sort of negative, irritated part of him relaxed because he was giving her a voice. So it's actually really important for men. I focus on women in this book because of my own feeling of the, I feel passionately that we need to get the feminine back, but this really isn't a female issue. Women don't oppress themselves. Patriarchy is created by men. Women didn't make it, you know? And so we can't also take it away, you know, until men realize it's their issue too, and that they're missing something by not having an honored feminine. And, you know, I was thinking about you and Siddhi Ma as in the Ma's around Maharaji, that this was the feminine aspect that was surrounding him. Like, you know, in the Guru Rinpoche prayer, Kordu Khandro, he's surrounded by Dakini. And that aspect of Siddhi Ma and the Ma's created like the container for Maharaji to be in, and also fed all of you who were around the nurturing of the feminine principle in that situation.
That's beautifully said, and it was quite real for us for all those years. There's a story in the book, and I think it's really important. You were, I believe you're in Bali, and there was somebody who came along who wasn't part of the retreat that you were going over there with, but she wanted to join the retreat. Can you tell that story a little bit? Because it's...
Yeah, that was very interesting. Yeah, so we arrive in Bali. I'm going to teach a Dakini retreat with a lion-headed Dakini in a place called Singaraja, which means the Lion King. So I'm in Ubud. We all have jet lag. I'm with my kids who are little, that not so little, like maybe 11 and 13, just with the girls at that time, not my son. And so we decided to go for a walk at like 3 a.m. We're all awake. We're walking through the countryside, and then we kind of came down the street in a little village, and we came across people who were in the middle of the street chopping something. And since they were the only other humans around at that hour, we stopped and talked to them, and they were preparing for a funeral of a woman. And So we kept returning, you know, because this jet lag was going on for a while. And then we got invited to the funeral. So we went to the funeral, and I'm at the funeral, and there's another Western woman there. And she's looking at, she keeps looking at me, and I'm so finally she came up to me and she said, "Why are you blue?" And I was like, "I'm not blue." I said, no, you blue. And I said, "Oh, I understand. Because I practice the blue-black Dakini. That's my main practice. So I'm spending a considerable part of the day visualizing myself as this blue-black Dakini, lion-headed Dakini." And she said, "Lion-headed Dakini?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "I just received that empowerment in Austria. And I came to Bali to do a retreat of the lion-headed Dakini." And I just, yes. And I just was looking for a place to do it. And I said, "Well, no accidents. I think, you know, you should come to this retreat. But we work with emotions, you know, at these retreats. Not just meditation, we work with transforming emotions." And she said, "Oh, emotions. Those are just waves in the ocean, you know. You shouldn't pay any attention to them." And I said, "Yeah, they are just waves in the ocean, but we need to pay attention to them. Because if we don't, the waves become a storm and we get tidal waves." Anyway, she agreed to come to the retreat, sort of reluctant about this emotion thing, but she came. And the first night of the retreat, I was in my room, and one of the assistant teachers came running in, and she said, her name was Andrea, I think. "Andrea, fell from the second floor onto concrete. It was a horrible sound." So she'd been climbing up a ladder into this Balinese house, and she'd fallen and onto concrete. And so I went to see her. I said, "I think you should go to the hospital, possibly Australia, because that's the only good hospitals at that time." This was 1990. And she said, "I don't want to go." And I said, "Okay, well, you can stay tonight, see how you are tomorrow. But if you're not better, you know, you're going to need to go." And so she was projectile vomiting, which is a sign of very bad concussion. She couldn't move. She couldn't sit up. So the next day I said, "Okay, well, try one thing. We'll do the chud practice for you," which is this practice of, it's a shamanic Tibetan practice in which you feed your demons. So I set it up with some of my more senior students. We put her, sat, you know, around where she was lying on this couch under this outdoor area in Bali by the ocean. And I was like, "Okay, I'm going to try this, but I don't think it's going to work, and we're going to have to airlift her." And so I closed my eyes. I know the practice by heart, and did it. And it takes about maybe 25, 30 minutes to do. And when I opened my eyes again, she was sitting up smiling, bowing, and then she got up.
Wow.
And what I had seen in the practice were all these things coming out of her, coming up from her sexual area out through her mouth, like these sort of white, like ghosts, kind of like spirit things, and there were a lot of them, and it was very intense. But I kept my eyes closed. I just kept doing it until they were all fed. And then when I opened my eyes, the people that were with me said, "You know, we were going to stop you because she went into a, you know, like a fit. She was jerking all over, and we were really afraid of what was happening. But since you kept going, we just let it go. And then it went on for a while, and then it stopped. And so I said to her afterwards, you know, privately, of course, I said, you know, I saw something coming out of your sexual area and out of your mouth. And what I would guess from this is that you have a history of sexual abuse and that you were not allowed to talk about it. So that's why your mouth. And she got completely white, and she said, "How did you know?
Wow.
How did you know? I am adopted, and my adopted father abused me, and I was so afraid of being thrown out and having no family, I didn't say anything, and it went on for years." So she had all this buried stuff, you know, that. And no wonder she didn't want to work with her emotions. Yeah. You know? So, yeah, that's the story.
And it's not uncommon story, unfortunately. But I think just in terms of how many, and I see many people who take advantage of Buddhism, both Hinayana, Vajrayana, Mahayana, whatever. And maybe this is Ram Dass's bugaboo about it. They don't attend to the deepest part of their emotions, and they don't attend to their heart. And you say in this book, in my experience, although it is true on the absolute level that emotions are waves, on the relative level, we need to work with our emotions and transform them in a tangible way. That's a huge takeaway for people to absolutely consider when they're on the path and practicing, for sure. So
you know, the something I was just thinking about today is attachment, you know, and there's all these attachment theories now about how important attachment is, and and how Buddhism, because it talks about being not attached, that attachment is a problem, it's a perfect refuge for someone who isn't healthily attached to those they're intimate with, starting with their parents. So then they go, oh, non-attachment. Yeah, I'll be safe there. You know, I don't have to connect with anybody. And, and it's what the Buddha advised.
The bypass stuff, spiritual bypassing. That we go. So Lama, we're close to the end, but I do want to get something from you, because what we've been doing, and I'll just briefly tell you, I did a podcast some time ago, a couple of months ago, with Robert Svoboda. I don't know if you know Robert or who he is, but Robert wrote these great Agora books about his guru, Vimalananda, who was an Agora in India. And the third of the books was called The Law of Karma, and it just... We've been talking to our mutual friends, or I have been, Sharon, about, we have a whole thing going on. I'm trying to get her to write a book called Getting Real, because a friend asked her, what do you do in your practice? And she said, I sit and I get real. That's what I do. And so we're on this whole thing about getting real and dealing with our day-to-day projections, the story we tell ourselves, and habitual patterns. And that led me to Robert really, there are some wonderful things around karma, and obviously karma, the action of body, speech, and mind, it affects every aspect of our lives. And I'm trying to just get out of all of our friends a little bit about how the wisdom of karma can really help us in our day-to-day practical way of dealing with some of the habituations that have been there through cause and effect all the way to past lifetimes. Can I just get you to say a little bit about how you've looked at karma in, you know, through your own prism, through your life, and how understanding of its principles perhaps has really helped you?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a big question throwing over the wall, but
the word karma means action, and the way it's been understood in the West is basically about past karma is what people think karma is, but karma is action. And so it's actually right now we're creating karma. You and I are creating karma with all these people that are listening to this, because we're impacting them with our words, and if they can see them visually as well. So I think your question is, how do I relate to karma? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
What I've noticed is that the more I've practiced, the faster karma ripens. I think when you start out, you've got so much stuff, so much accumulated past karma that it's kind of like, karma ripens, and there need to be causes and conditions. So there's the seed of a karmic act that you do, but it doesn't always ripen immediately. Often it will be even lifetimes before it ripens. And that's why people say, how can you say karma exists when look at Hitler? Nothing really happened to him. He just died, but it will. So what I've noticed is that I don't know if it's just being on the path, or maybe over the years things clearing more so that there was less sort of backlog through practice and purification and so on. But what I've noticed is if I do something either positive or negative, that it seems like the results come very quickly. And the other thing that I've noticed is it's inescapable. Like you can't do something and like, okay, but that one doesn't count, like that's not going to go in my karmic bank, one of the things that says in one of my texts is karma is infallible. It's a law, and we call it a law. It's not like you can pick and choose what karma accrues. It's not a choice. It's action, and it has a reaction. So I think that's made me try to clear things up that aren't good with people quicker, because then if you don't, it's going to be another life you have to do it in. And of course, not to create things that you will have to deal with in that way. And then also to try to generate merit. And I think merit is something that we underestimate in Buddhist teachings in the West. The importance of sonam, that doing good things, generosity, kindness, all of those things that accumulate positively, that it's really important to consciously do that, not just like happen to do it. And I think that's a way that we in the West are different than Asian Buddhists, who are very aware of that. And they do it a lot consciously. They actually do things that create positive karma, because they understand that it is infallible. And if you want happiness, which we all do, then create your happiness now by what you do, because your present is your future. You're creating your future now.
Yeah. And a little bit maybe about one last thing just around this subject. The advantage of practicing of awareness, understanding motivation, understanding the creation, getting, I guess, enough spaciousness to see where these actions can sometimes go a long way to supporting the endemic habitual patterns that we create for ourselves. How do you see us being able to get into a sort of a gap that that you're not, that there's enough spaciousness that you can actually witness what you're, you know, what you're creating all the way to motivation.
Yeah, well, meditation. I think we're understanding more and more the importance of meditation. If we think of it as like daily life, it is like having water in a jar with dirt in it, and we spend all day doing this, shaking it up. So we can't see through that water, right? When we meditate, we put that jar down and it settles, right? And then you can see through the water. If you just keep shaking, it's not going to happen. And so all these scientific studies that are being done now about how meditation helps you be more productive, it lowers your blood pressure and so on, all that are, you know, sort of in a way worldly benefits that are now convincing people they should do it. But really, it is that sense of letting it all settle, partly to create the space to be aware of what we're doing when we're not meditating. And also when you sit, and here, you know, the whole community just came out of a 2-week retreat where everybody was alone for 2 weeks in their cabin. And people said it was, you know, a lot of people said it was really hard because all these things came up that I haven't looked at, you know? So that's part of it, settling. Then you see these things that when you're shaking the jar, you don't see them. So meditation creates that space from which you then go into your day or your life. And with that space, then you're going a little bit slower. You're going with a little bit more awareness. You're less likely to just be reactive and bouncing off the walls and creating more confusion than if you actually stop. And so really, I really think it's meditation. You know, and of course, motivation is important. The motivation to practice for all beings. We have a yogi now living at Taramandala who was in retreat for 16 years. Amazing, beautiful yogi. And so he taught an open meditation to this, you know, at an open house that we have in Pagosa Springs, Colorado, which is, it's not a sophisticated audience. And he said to the people, if you don't have motivation to practice for all beings, you shouldn't meditate. And then, you know, our director said to me today, she said, I don't think you should say that to these people because, you know, they don't even know what that means, like motivation. They just want to learn to meditate. But I realized how, you know, him doing that was how that idea of bodhicitta or intention to benefit others, to act for the benefit of beings, so imbued in the teaching and in the practice that it's like you wouldn't teach meditation without it. Right. Now meditation is being taught without it, you know, like, you know, it's because it's going to make you feel better. And I actually think that's fine. I think it can go slowly, you know, you realize the benefits that you're calmer, your blood pressure is lower, whatever. And then those teachings of motivation can come into it. But it's good to have that come along fairly soon.
Yeah.
In terms of training.
Yeah, especially when we all realize just the level of our self-cherishing, as the Tibetans do put it, which I think is a beautiful term. That level is so high. It's what when we went and we were with Neem Karoli Baba in India and saw, oh my God, you can be there without that eye that is predominant around satisfying the, as Krishnadas calls it, the movie of me day in, day out. And, you know, that, of course, he was that example. He is that example. Karmapa is that example and many others. But so I do believe that that motivation to not just have the self-interest of lower blood pressure, etc., is highly important and goes a long way. And when we're talking about karma, to really understanding that how interconnected we are karmically with everybody. And I think that goes a long way to helping change our perspective. This is great. Always great to hang out with you, Lama. So everybody, the book is Wisdom Rising, and you can...
I actually have a copy here.
Yeah, there's a copy. Oh, beautiful.
That's a galley, so it's not on the market yet, but...
But it, just pre-order it. You'll get all of the information when you go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling, and we'll have everything there, all the links, and we'll even put a link to the I Ching, so you can kind of investigate that. That came out, and of course Jung, some of Jung's stuff. I mean, we'll put a bunch of different things up there, that hopefully will help on a day to day. So, and also, we will also put a link to Tara Mandala, and you can connect up and visit if you're in Colorado. And
I'll be on the East Coast in various places with the book.
Doing a tour in the summer of 18?
Yeah, in May, actually. I'll be at Kripalu May 10th to 13th with Krishnadas.
Mm-hmm.
And Shiva Ray.
That's great.
3 days. Yeah.
He'll be running there.
New York at ABC Home on the 17th of May. And I'll be in Washington and Boston and Nova Scotia and Key West, Florida, and a bunch of places.
That'll all be on the website. You'll be able to link over to Tara Mandala, and you'll see all of that. And if you're in the neighborhood, please... go down, and Lama will surely autograph the book when you buy it. So there you go.
True.
Love you, man. It's so great to just be with you. And this is always such a great opportunity for me. Never mind just doing a podcast. This is for me, as well as everybody else. So this is Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/ just go there. Actually, all of Lama and my friends are up there, from Krishnadas to Sharon Salzberg to Joseph Goldstein to Lama Surya, and more, much more, Jack Kornfield. And enjoy. And meanwhile, we shall see you next week on Mind Rolling.